The Methodology Center Perspective Podcast is brought to you by the Methodology Center at Penn State, your source for cutting-edge research methodology in the social, behavioral, and health sciences.
Hello, and welcome to Methodology Minutes. I'm your host, Amanda Applegate, and our guest today is Susan Murphy. She's the Methodology Center Principal Investigator, H.E. Robbins Professor of Statistics, Research Professor in the Institute of Social Research, and Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan. Susan was named a MacArthur Fellow in 2013 for her work on the Sequential Multiple Assignment Randomized Trial. We've wanted to record a podcast with her since the Methodology Minutes podcast series began. Susan, thank you so much for being here, and welcome to Methodology Minutes.
It's great to be here.
And congratulations on your MacArthur Award. I'd love to start by hearing a little bit about what that has been like. How did hearing the news impact you, and what has changed in the months since you learned about the award?
The best thing was the confidence that it gave a variety of clinical and behavioral scientists to go forward with these more unusual designs. They're having to leave tradition behind, and it is risky for them. This award gives them a lot of confidence that they can pull it off, that it's going to work out for them. That's the main thing that's happened, is that my collaborators have more confidence, and many more potential collaborators have been contacting me about these types of designs.
Fantastic. So the MacArthur Foundation recognized you for your work on the Sequential Multiple Assignment Randomized Trial, or SMART, and of course it is a very new and can be daunting for some new researchers. Can you talk a little bit about this trial design and what inspired you to develop it?
I was working with researchers in substance use, and we now understand that for many people, substance use tends to have a very chronic or a waxing and waning course. Also, many of our interventions will only work for maybe one half or 60% of the people. And even if it does work for the person, the treatment or the intervention works for the person, often over time it may stop working.
Right.
So in those kinds of settings, clinicians and behavioral scientists, they have to think about what sequence of treatments am I going to provide to this person, because the chance of the first treatment curing that person is not all that high.
Right.
So they have to have a whole plan for how long are they going to try this first treatment, and if the treatment doesn't work, what treatment should they try next? Or if the treatment is working, many of these treatments are burdensome, so often they'll want to think, well, what kind of maintenance therapy might I provide? So the big questions that motivate this type of trial are questions concerning sequences of treatments. What treatment do I try first? What treatment do I try second if the response is insufficient? And how do I use how the patient is responding to the treatment to make those decisions?
Okay, so you're able to kind of customize it to how that person is doing.
You want to collect data that will allow you to do that customization.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So in recent years, we know that there's been a large number of SMART studies to address a broad array of health problems. Can you give us a few examples of something in the field?
Yes, I'd like to talk about two examples in particular. One example is the very first one I was involved with. This study was run by Dave Oslin at UPenn, and he had a lot of guts to do this because it was brand new. And the setting itself is quite interesting. At that time, naltrexone, which is an opioid receptor antagonist, was provided often to people who had alcohol dependence. There was a lot of problems with naltrexone because people would suffer side effects and they would stop taking the medication, or the medication wouldn't work and thus they would stop taking the medication. So he wanted to try and better understand how to build a strategy, an algorithm around using naltrexone to help people. The questions that arose in trying to build that algorithm were, how long do you try naltrexone before you say, look, it's not working, we got to try something different? And in this case, not working could be not working because the person didn't take the drug.
Right.
So the first question, or the first randomization, is to how long you try the drug before you try it. It was to either 5 or 2 heavy drinking days.
Okay.
So if someone was randomized to 5 heavy drinking days, they were allowed a lot more time to try to respond to naltrexone than in the other case. In either case, as soon as a person met the trigger for this heavy drinking days, they would be immediately re-randomized to either a switch in treatment, so just give up on naltrexone, or to combining naltrexone with a behavioral therapy, which is designed to improve adherence to naltrexone. Because one of the reasons why they might not be responding is because they weren't adhering to the drug. The behavioral intervention might help them adhere to the drug. And so this study is a SMART, it's one of the very first. It is the very first that I was involved from the beginning to the end with. The two big questions were how long to try the initial treatment and what treatment to try next, if there was response or if there was non-response. The other study is a study that just got funded only within the last month, and it's really exciting. Whereas Oslin's study was for alcohol-dependent subjects, and all the treatments in the study concerned treatments for patients who were alcohol-dependent. This other study that just was funded, it's going into the field, Amy Kilborn at the University of Michigan is the PI, and Danny Amaral, one of my collaborators, was the primary person involved in the design. And this design, it has to do with a treatment or an intervention that's for the clinic as opposed to the patient. So this intervention is called Replicating Effective Programs. It's an intervention that's provided to the clinic to help the clinic then provide another intervention, evidence-based intervention, to patients. So this is called an implementation intervention because it's not, the intervention is not on the patients, it's on the clinicians in the clinic. And in this particular case, the evidence-based interventions at the patient level that they're trying to ensure is implemented is called Life Goals Collaborative Care. It's a psychosocial intervention for people who have mental illness. Let's go back to our implementation intervention, that is the intervention that's acting on the clinic level, on the clinicians. There is this effective program called Replicating Effective Programs, and it works pretty well, but around 50% of the time, a clinic site doesn't respond well to it. And this is because there's a lot of obstacles to changing the provision of treatment to a more evidence-based program.
Right.
And so because you have this amount of heterogeneity, only around half of the sites may respond, or even maybe only 25% of the sites will respond. That is, they'll start implementing the evidence-based program.
Okay.
You have to think, what can I do for this site? What intervention, what other thing besides replicating effective programs can I do for this site so that they'll actually implement the evidence-based Life Goals Clinical Care? And what Amy came up with, developed, was this external facilitators and internal facilitators. And external facilitators are people who sit at a central location, and people at the site can access and talk to the external facilitators, get advice on how to make sure Life Goals Collaborative Care is really implemented.
Okay, troubleshooting.
That sort of thing. And this is certainly more expensive than replicating effective programs, the original program. But it's not all that expensive because there's one person and many sites can access the help of that one person. That's one option. Then another option is called internal facilitators. This is very expensive. This is a person who has protected time at the clinic with the sole purpose during that protected time to improve the implementation of the evidence-based practice. So what Amy did was, Amy Kilborn, the PI of this study, in working with Danny, they decided they had to come together and they had to decide what are the big important questions that would motivate this SMART trial. And the big questions were which treatment to provide to sites that are insufficient responders to standard replicating effective programs. Should you provide the really expensive one or the less expensive one? And then if a treatment continued to show non-response, what should you do? And the whole goal of these implementation interventions, that is these facilitators, these different internal versus external facilitators, is at the end of the day, people who have mood disorders should see their life improve. In particular, the primary outcome is a quality of life measure for mental health at the patient level. Even though the implementation intervention is acting on the clinic, on the physicians, the clinicians, the goal is to improve the patient's life. So what's going to happen is 100 clinics are going to start with replicating effective programs. They're going to be followed for 6 months. and then they'll be assessed as to whether or not they've effectively implemented Life Goals Collaborative Care. If they have it, and they're expecting around 75 of the 100 programs not to have implemented it, then each clinic will be randomized to either add an external facilitator or add both the external and the internal facilitator, very expensive option.
Yes.
Then the clinics will be followed for another 6 months. Again, they'll be assessed to see if they're adequately implementing Life Goals Collaborative Care. And among the clinics who are continuing not to respond sufficiently to, that is, implement Life Goals Collaborative Care, these clinics will then again be re-randomized. In particular, it's the clinics that started off with just the external facilitator. They'll be re-randomized to either continue with the external facilitator, maybe if we just try it for another 6 months, they'll finally be able to get it implemented, or we'll actually add the internal facilitator, the most expensive option. At the end of the day, one would like to end up with a sequence of implementation interventions, a sequence of treatments that is not terribly expensive. So you don't have to, at the very beginning, start with both external and internal facilitators. You only use these internal facilitators if all else fails.
When they absolutely need it.
And that's the idea here, is that you're going to have a sequence of treatments for the clinics.
Right. There's kind of a path that they'll follow.
Right, that they'll follow. And if the clinics are not adhering well, then you'll have to change their intervention. You'll have to step up their intervention. So when you contrast these two SMARTs, one is at the patient level, it's talking about treatments for patients. The other is talking about treatments for clinics to ensure that the clinics implement best practices. Everything, always, the end point is to improve patient health.
Wow.
In both cases, but in one case you're acting on the clinic level, the clinicians, in the other case you're directly acting on the patient level.
Wow.
Very interesting.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
So listeners who want to learn more about SMART can listen to Podcast 12 with Susan's former protege and current colleague, Methodology Center investigator Danny Almirall, or visit the Adaptive Interventions research page on the Methodology Center website. As excited as the MacArthur Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, and the Methodology Center are about SMART, you've also branched out into an even newer field of research. Can you tell us about your latest work on just-in-time adaptive interventions, or JEDIs?
The interventions that are developed by SMART they're called adaptive interventions, and they're aimed at helping clinicians help you. So how do clinicians help you if you're alcohol dependent? How do we get clinicians to help you if you have mood disorders? This is a different thing. This is about helping you help yourself. The adaptive interventions that we've been talking about are about big decisions. What treatment, medication to try first, or how long to try that medication, or what behavioral treatment to try, or how long to try it. Here, these interventions are momentary interventions that act in the moment. And so they're designed to be implemented on a mobile device, such as your smartphone, and they would help you manage any kind of behavior change that you would like to happen. I'll give you an example of this. This is a project we've just started working on. Suppose you had a heart attack, and now you've been through an intensive program where people have helped you learn how to eat the right foods, prepare the right foods, exercise, and so on.
Okay.
You've made it through this intensive out program, but you have to now maintain your exercise, or you're going to lose a lot of the benefits and you'll be at much higher risk of having another heart attack.
Right.
So how can we help you in that endeavor? And one way is by having a little coach that resides on your phone that would potentially give you suggestions during the day about how you might increase the activity in the day, during the day.
Okay.
It wouldn't give you suggestions when you don't need it. It should only give you suggestions when you need those suggestions. It might help you figure out how to organize your day so that you can make sure you make it to the gym and not get distracted.
Oh, okay.
So these are just-in-time adaptive interventions. They provide support as you go about your life so that you can achieve your goals, your longer-term goals. It's very hard often to think longer term when short term you're really hungry and the person next to you is eating a brownie and you want a brownie too.
Yes.
You know? And so how do you deal with that momentary challenge? These little interventions, they're little behavioral strategies that you can try. Some of them are cognitive and some are behavioral, some are motivational. Like a behavioral strategy might be go for a walk rather than sit and watch your colleagues eat cookies at break time.
A good idea for all of us.
Is that right? Or a motivational strategy, there may be pictures of your family on the phone, or maybe how you used to look when you weighed a lot less and how you want to look in the future. Ways to help you stay on target.
Right.
And remember what your long-term goals are, even though you're having these momentary stressors right now.
Right.
You're really craving that brownie or that cookie.
Right.
Other interventions are cognitive, where maybe you've slipped up, you had a cookie, and you have to reframe how you think about that. You can't think that you failed. You know, you have to think, well, this is a lapse, but I'm going to do better next time. So you reframe that a lapse.
So you can stay motivated.
So you could stay motivated,
right.
Exactly. These types of interventions are of great interest in recovery support and substance abuse as well.
Yeah.
Because that's an area in which you really need, you know, if you've reduced your use of substances, or hopefully eliminated the use of illegal substances, you really want to stay off these drugs. But you're probably experiencing a lot of craving. And how do you deal? Craving is a very momentary experience. And how do you either get distracted so you don't feel it, or how do you substitute one behavior for another? How can we help you do that?
Yeah.
And the great thing about these types of interventions, of course, is they're available any time of the day, any time of the night.
Yeah.
That's the just-in-time aspect.
And the things you're talking about are things that happen at all times of day or night.
Right.
It's not, you know, when
in
you
the
take
middle
a medication,
of the night.
You might only take it once a day.
Right.
So there's not that necessarily that
momentary
decision.
Aspect.
But
yeah.
It's, you know, drinking and there's alcohol in the house.
Right.
You think about it 20 times a day.
Right. Or in the middle of the night, you wake up and you want ice cream.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Or whatever. It's just, it's really hard. The just-in-time is about that idea of just-in-time.
Okay.
And the adaptive aspect is that we'll only provide you a suggestion when you really need it. We won't just provide you suggestions at random.
Okay.
Rather, that when you're experiencing a lot of craving or a lot of stress, that's when you get the suggestion
or
strategies that you might use to get over that hump.
And then when things are going well, the app
we
would
don't
just
bother
leave you alone.
You. Right.
Okay.
Or like if we try to collect information about the level of burden that the app is placing on you. And so if you're feeling a lot of burden or you're becoming disengaged, we try something different rather than the same old thing. So that's the adaptive aspect of the JEDI.
It's interesting that it can adapt in so many different ways.
Yeah.
Many different
assets. And you have to just decide if you're a behavioral scientist or a clinician and you're trying to develop one of these just-in-time adaptive interventions, you have to decide which aspects you want to focus on. What parts of that person's obstacles do you want to help them overcome? And that's what you focus on in terms of the adaptation.
So just one more question. What do you see as the future of SMARTs and JEDIs?
To me, one of the biggest areas of health is the maintenance of behavior change. This is one of the most difficult areas, and it's one of the most important, because much of the morbidity, that is the problems people suffer later in life, are due to our own behaviors.
Yeah.
And we don't really want to do this to ourselves. It's just in a momentary way, it seems like a good idea. And there's all these things going on in our life. You know, our children may be experiencing difficulties, and it's very hard to stay focused on the fact that I'm trying to have a good diet when I'm having to deal with my child's problems in school. You know, there's just, life happens. There's just so much going on. And so maintenance of health behavior change is really a big challenge. SMARTs are a clinical trial design. JEDIs are a treatment design.
Okay.
Because you could, in fact, investigate a JEDI in a SMART.
Oh,
I'll talk to you about that shortly.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll tell you about it in just a second. But both of these are about sequencing treatments. In one case, it's sequencing, you know, medication followed by behavioral therapy or vice versa. and the other is about momentary treatments, momentary interventions, but it's still sequencing of treatments.
Right.
They're both about sequencing treatments. One is just real time and one is more coarser periods in time.
Oh, interesting.
Right now already, one of my collaborators was speaking to me about a SMART that she's working on. Her name is Billy Nahumshani, and she just submitted a grant to do a SMART trial. They're investigating several interventions. This is for adults who are obese, and they're trying to eat smart,
okay,
eat right. And there's traditional types of interventions like meal replacements and different behavioral therapies. And there's also the potential to have a JEDI on a smartphone. She's very interested in forming a sequence of treatments that doesn't cost a lot. And so you don't want to use meal replacements until you really need to, and until there's a lot of evidence.
Right.
So where does a JEDI, which is really a low-cost intervention because it's operating by the phone, where can it fit in to that paradigm when it's being paired up with these other types of more formal interventions like meal replacements or counseling sessions?
Okay.
Should we bring in JEDIs later or earlier? Can some people just work with a JEDI on their phone and do okay initially,
okay,
and not require the more intensive, more formal treatment? Or should you have a JEDI that works concurrently and supports a more formal, intensive treatment? And these are the kinds of questions that SMARTs can address.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
It's very interesting.
They
so they're coming together.
Yeah.
Right. And the real reason is because they're both about sequencing. And so you can think of a JEDI as a treatment. And is it one of the treatments in your sequence?
Right.
Yeah.
Eventually you...
Yeah. Should it be an early treatment, or should it be an adjunctive treatment, or should it be a treatment that you only use after they've made a lot of progress, and then you use it so that they can maintain their behavior change?
You know,
where
right.
does it fit in that sequence?
Right.
I think this is where SMARTs and JEDIs are going. Of course, JEDIs is... That whole concept is a much newer type. It's much newer than this concept of
right.
adaptive interventions. And so it in itself requires a lot of development. But nonetheless, already we're seeing it enter into a SMART.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's the second setting in which I know of someone implementing a SMART with a JEDI as one of the components.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Very neat.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for making time to sit down with me. It's been great talking to you, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
You have been listening to the Methodology Center Perspective Podcast, brought to you by the Methodology Center at Penn State, your source for cutting-edge research methodology in the social, behavioral, and health sciences. This podcast is available on iTunes and on the Methodology Center's website at methodology.psu.edu.